In the summer of 1964, Mississippi was a work in progress. Civil rights leaders brought in more than 1,000 volunteers, mostly white students from the North, to teach classes and to register black voters and to organize for change. But the white leaders of local communities responded, and not so well. By the end of Freedom Summer, there'd be thousands of arrests and dozens of black church and business bombings and burnings, and a handful of lives ended with gunshots. Another kind of shooting, though, helps that summer live on in our memory and in our understanding. A group of photographers spent that summer recording those activists' work, the real life of black communities, and a pivotal moment of political organizing that took many in those small Mississippi communities all the way to the national political stage. One of those photographers is out with a new book that tells us that story in words and pictures, and Matt Herron joins us this morning. Good morning, Matt.
Hi, Brian.
So glad you could be with
us.
Glad
to be here.
The book is called Mississippi Eyes, and I'm looking at the photos on pages 88 and 89 of the book. It's a remarkable collection of photography. And in these pictures, there's a black woman standing at a microphone on a small wood platform in her Sunday dress and her white gloves, and she's addressing this big group outdoors. But between her and the crowd is a pile of rubble and debris. What's happened in that photo?
That is Mrs. Cheney. She's the mother of James Cheney, who was murdered in Neshoba County right at the beginning of the summer, along with Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman. So they were going to investigate the burning of the Mount Zion Baptist Church. And after the funeral, folks congregated at the church for a memorial service. It seemed like the appropriate place for it, and Mrs. Cheney is talking to a group of people who are scattered around in the ruins of the church. That was really, I guess, the pivotal moment that began the summer, and it focused for all of us the seriousness of what we were doing and the danger.
Matt Herron, this book that you've written as well as put together, taken many of the photos, it's filled with powerful images. And I guess I want you to take us back to how this came to be in the first place. You are a white man. You went to Princeton University. And in 1964, you had two preschool-age children. What took you to the Mississippi Delta?
Well, my wife and I were living in Philadelphia, and I was organizing peace demonstrations for the American Society, or the American, for the Quakers. And we were very concerned about nonviolence. We were trying to practice it. But from the South, there was this siren call of kids sitting in at lunch counters, being beaten. Martin Luther King was had carried on a boycott nonviolently, and we felt like in order to be relevant, we had to go south. It was the kind of call that hundreds of other people received in their own way. I guess the difference was that we had two kids, and so we were very concerned about their safety. Janine, my wife, went first. She marched in Medgar Evers' funeral procession in the summer of 1963 in Jackson. And she also, her mission was to find out whether it would be safe for us to move with our kids to Jackson. She was told if we lived in a white neighborhood, we could do it. But Jackson was the only place where it would be safe. So we did. We moved south. I was starting my budding career as a magazine photojournalist. I'd had an eight-page story in Look and a picture in Life, but more importantly, I knew the editors. I'd been visiting them in New York on a regular basis. So I thought, I can come south, work for them, and at the same time help out with the civil rights movement, primarily the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was running things in Mississippi. So I helped set up the SNCC darkroom in Atlanta, and I cooperated with them. And as plans began to develop to bring all these students into the state, the question to myself was, what can I do? I had earlier tried to start a documentary photography project in New York, and that had foundered on the busy schedules of all the people we wanted to run the program. But I thought, here's a unique opportunity. As a young photographer, I had met Dorothea Lange a couple of times, so I wrote to Dorothea.
Famous documentary photographer herself, right?
Yeah, Dorothea was one of the best-known photographers in the Farm Security Administration team that documented the Dust Bowl in the 30s and 40s. So probably almost everyone has seen her photographs. Anyway, Dorothea encouraged me. I went to New York. I tried to raise money. I recruited photographers. And by early summer, we were back in Mississippi ready to go.
How important do you feel like taking photographs of what was happening was in terms of the broader civil rights struggle? I mean, there were people there who were registering voters. There were people there who were teaching classes. How did your taking of photographs fit into that broader struggle?
Well, it was clear to all of us that we couldn't do this alone. We had to enlist the whole country, or at least the parts of the country that were favorable to our cause. And photographs were the way to do it, as somebody famously said, the mirror with a memory. So we were hooked up to one of the major picture agencies in that era, Black Star, and also SNCC had a communications office run by Julian Bond, and they piped photographs north to the major publications. So we felt like our job was not to demonstrate and become heroes and go to jail, but to witness what was going on, to report it, and to record it as best we could. I always knew I was photographing history.
You knew that this was history in the making.
I knew it was history. None of us knew how it would turn out. I don't think we had very elevated ideas about how successful we would be, but we had to do it. It was our mission. And so I photographed a lot of things I might not have if I'd been just on a magazine assignment, because I thought they would become part of a public record, and that turned out to be true.
Well, and I'm looking at the book here. There's 160 images in the book. It starts capturing pretty ordinary life, muddy fields, the places where black people in the South lived and worked, but also the life of the political class. I mean, you shot the inauguration of the new governor, for example. The contrasts seem very significant.
Yeah, that was a strange moment. I arrived on assignment for Time. I felt like I was stepping onto the surface of Mars. What happened around me was so strange to my eyes that I felt almost like a spy, although nobody paid any attention to me. I was just part of the event, but I shot politicians and beauty queens on parade and black sanitation workers in their work clothes looking at these magnificent floats and so on. It seemed to me an opportunity to document rather than just report the folkways of Mississippi and Mississippi politicians. I felt like my documentary and antenna were waving furiously in the air as I moved around with my cameras.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture here with the beauty queen waving on the float, as beauty queens and parades do everywhere and always. But there are the sanitation workers there to pick up the horse manure behind the float.
Yeah, exactly. And my ironic title for that is Advanced Training, which you see as a sign on the building behind the beauty queen.
Wow. We're talking with Matt Herron. He's a photojournalist and author as well of this book, Mississippi Eyes, that chronicles the Southern Documentary Project of 1964. I want to invite our listeners into the conversation. We're talking about images of the civil rights struggle. What snapshots do you carry in your own mind of this period in our nation's life? Is there an image, maybe from the pages of a book or from television, maybe one that you saw with your own eyes that tells the story for you even better than words. Or do you have a question for Matt Herron? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. It's 235-2888. We also check our email at updatedate@kcur.org. Matt Herron, you go on to show the work of the volunteers, their teaching, their voter registration activities. You also document the efforts over in Alabama. You get out of Mississippi at one point, and you talk about your tactics for being a civil rights photographer in the Deep South, some rules that you sort of adopted. Can you talk a little bit about that, how to survive? Your first rule is never be a hero.
Yeah, you know, in some ways I thought Alabama was the scariest state in the South. Mississippi was bad, but they were sort of disorganized. But Alabama really had some of the attributes of a police state. At any rate, as I said earlier, we were witnesses, and if we got arrested, went to jail, we weren't heroes. We were first-class chumps because we had not fulfilled our responsibility to get the film, get out of the situation, get to the airport, put the film on a plane, and send it to New York. So almost anything that would allow us to carry on this mission was acceptable. My favorite police pass was a Birmingham police pass. And you know, there were times when I faked a New Orleans accent and dissembled if necessary. And sometimes there was nothing to do but cut and run. So that was rule number one.
And I think we have a photo of you cutting and running, literally running from a sheriff. That's up on our web page. You can check it out at kcur.org.
Yeah. Another rule was always act as if you had absolute privilege and right to be where you were doing what you were doing. And people would assume that somebody had given you permission. There is a story about one of our photographers, Danny Lyon, who came into a forest glade early in the morning with the smoldering ruins of a church that had been burned probably by the Klan. And he was all alone, and in a few seconds later, a sheriff's car came up into the grove with its flashes flashing. That was a very dangerous situation. A lone photographer, a lone armed sheriff with no witnesses anywhere. Danny went straight over to the sheriff, showed him his credentials, and said, "Hi, I'm Danny Lyon. I'm here to photograph the church. The FBI will be here in 5 minutes." The sheriff then pulled out his credentials to show to Danny to demonstrate his right to be there. We did that sort of thing from time to time. Another rule I had was always keep moving. If you're in a situation that's developing rapidly, the best pictures are always available if you're moving around a lot. But also, if there are a couple of good old boys who are thinking about beating up on you, you're usually gone by the time they've gotten there themselves together and figured out what to do with you. So movement was our friend. And I think the final one was, if everything else fails, take refuge in a black neighborhood.
Yeah, that surprised me. Yeah, why that?
Well, the South is different from the North. And I had the conviction that the first person I met in a black neighborhood, I could demonstrate by my respectful attitude and probably my accent that I was not a Southern segregationist. And if I asked for help, that person would certainly help me. And that happened many times. People risk their lives sometimes to help us. It was a struggle where we joined with the black community. So this was simply one more demonstration of it. And it worked for me on numerous occasions.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if you have questions for Matt Herron, the photographer behind the Southern Documentary Project. Akers has a question from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Akers.
Good morning. I'd just like to know what kind of camera and film they use.
Yeah, good logistical question. What is that of significance, Matt? What kind of camera were you using?
Well, the Nikon F was the camera of the day. And since we didn't have a lot of money, we lived on less than $25 a week, plus our travel expenses. We usually spooled our film from 100-foot rolls, loaded ourselves into cassettes, and it cost us a penny a frame to do that.
Wow.
And you could buy a Nikon F from Woods Photo Service in Hong Kong for $125 in those days, which was also what I earned as a day rate. So that was my rule of thumb.
The photojournalism world has obviously changed a lot. You couldn't take unlimited photos and just delete them from your camera. You had to make your frames count.
Yeah, but we did have some leeway. Shooting 35 is, well, I always think of it as making sketches for a final photograph, for final image, as artists do. So if there were a picture situation, I would move in on it. I would try different angles. And each time there was a little voice in the back of my head that said, yes, no, yes. And at that point, I'd zeroed in on the thing, and I just had a sense that that was the picture. Today we look at the screen to see if we've got it, but in those days it had to be in our mind.
And the mechanics, the logistics, how did you get the film developed? You probably didn't go down to your corner drugstore there in Greenwood, Mississippi, and ask them to develop the film.
No, absolutely not. I had a darkroom in my bathroom in Jackson. And some film, if I was shooting for the movement, why, I would probably develop it there because there might not be an immediate need for it. If it was something else, a demonstration or something, I would either drive to the airport or I would have somebody take it to the airport and put it on a plane. And usually it came, you know, in a packet. Life magazine backed our project with some money, with the idea that if something happened, we would be on hand to shoot for Life, and we did that a few times. Mm-hmm. So a packet would go out and with usually some scrawled caption notes on it, and it would go, generally speaking, to my agency in New York, Black Star. They would develop it, make contact sheets, and distribute it.
How many pictures have you ended up with from this period?
I have 27,000 civil rights images in my files. I run a small stock picture agency known as Take Stock. And I also have 50,000 images of Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers. Those are the two files that I work with.
And what will happen to all those photos? Are they will they be maintained in perpetuity somewhere?
Well, I hope so.
as much as you have control over that?
Mine are in a fireproof vault that I constructed, 2-hour firewall, steel door, and a swimming pool membrane over the top so when the fire department turns their hoses on my house, it won't go into that room. Yeah. I've been trying for years to get a National Archive for Civil Rights Photography, and I've been talking to the Library of Congress and Smithsonian and lots of other people. So far, it hasn't happened, but I think that we may be moving in that direction. It's certainly historical work. It needs to be preserved. Already some, you know, vital files have been lost to fire or attrition. So that's one of the projects that I'm trying to move forward on.
Keep telling the story, Matt, and I'm sure folks will be taking you up on that offer. Matt Herron has been a photojournalist for more than 50 years. He founded and directed the Southern Documentary Project in 1964. Now he is the author and photographer behind Mississippi Eyes. He joined us this morning from KQED in San Francisco. Matt Herron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure to be here.